There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's Tuesday, December 20th, 2022, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The January 6th committee did an excellent job in fact-finding, presentation, and communicating its case. It all now culminates in criminal referrals to the Justice Department. Only it doesn't. The process was the culmination. These referrals have no force of law. You know that. The power, we're told, is symbolic, but I've been wondering, what is the difference in this case between symbolic and meaningless? Don't get me wrong, and former presidents, don't do me wrong. Donald Trump should pay for what he did in trying to overturn the results of the election. Therefore, if Georgia prosecutors think they have evidence, they'll bring charges. If Merrick Garland thinks that he could bring a federal case, he will. So the symbolism of the referrals are what? They symbolize the actual enforcement that sworn law enforcement officials with statutory power actually have? What kind of symbol is that? When the symbol is weaker than the actual, the symbol is at best adjacent to what we're talking about. It's sort of drafting along beside the real. It's like an ancient culture engaging in a rain prayer. Either it will rain or it won't rain. It's just that people yearn for an expression of their desire. And then afterwards, if it does rain, they can tell themselves, well, we did what we could. Luke Broadwater was on the New York Times podcast, The Daily, today. He's been covering these hearings. Here was his assessment.
Well, it is a symbolic act, but it is a powerfully symbolic act. It is the United States Congress saying we've thrown every resource imaginable into this investigation. And these are our conclusions. And we wish we had the power to charge, but we don't. And so right. The ball is now in your court. Now, of course, it doesn't oblige the Justice Department to do anything. The Justice Department doesn't have to listen to Congress. But it does create a tremendous amount of public pressure.
I'll go further than saying it doesn't oblige the Justice Department to act. I would say it shouldn't. It shouldn't oblige the Justice Department, because when Republicans control Congress in 2 weeks and they'll be asking for prosecutions of Hunter Biden or Alejandro Mayorkas or whomever, we should actually be saying, no, the Justice Department will and should be making independent assessments. And in all likelihood, that's also what the Justice Department is going to do here. But if they were going to act anyway, now with these referrals, it'll make it look political. And to that I say, yeah, so what, right? Everything looks or is said to look political. That's true. I wish it weren't the case, but it is. It's not a grievous error to put forward these referrals. I understand when you have a committee like the January 6th committee, this is the natural outgrowth of such a committee. If you just take their actions, their process, their findings, and it doesn't lead to a report with a do something clause, it will feel denuded. And of course, there is the chance that this does nudge the Justice Department into bringing charges they otherwise wouldn't. And that's good, right? I don't think it's good. Not if they weren't. If the Justice Department isn't going to do something, but public pressure makes them do something, we got to question their calculations in the first place, or ours, or the public's. Anyway, if the Justice Department were to act only or significantly because they're feeling pressure as symbolized in these referrals, it's not going to be conscious. It will just be a feeling in the ether that's pushing us towards this one conclusion. But overall, I do think it's not a positive development if the referrals work to bring pressure that otherwise wouldn't be there. The only way the referrals have a real-world impact is if something goes seriously wrong with the functioning of government. But of course, if there wasn't some serious government dysfunction to begin with, there would be no discussion that I'm engaged in now, no committee, no attack, and no threat to democracy in the form of one Donald J. Trump. on the show today. If you like my ambivalence as regard to what you just heard, wait till you hear my thoughts about criminal prosecution of a nonagenarian Nazi. But first, Sam Quinones is the author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Today we talk to him about homelessness and why cartel is kind of a grand name for the criminal gangs that have flooded the U.S. with this potent product. Sam Quinones up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Fentanyl and meth, the new kind of meth, are a different, deadlier, more dangerous type of drug than U.S. enforcement and social services have ever had to deal with. In this, part two of our interview with Sam Quinones, author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, I ask him about the root causes of why we, as humans, chase dopamine. I start by talking about the nucleus accumbens. That's the dopamine-receiving pleasure center of the brain. And I put to Sam my idea that we shouldn't have a drug czar. We should have a nucleus accumbens czar. How America, with our tawdry sideshow history, our embrace of hucksterism, is more oriented towards the dopamine fix and the mistake of pleasure for contentment.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, man. I think that's exactly what's going on. There's a whole lot of that. You know, take a look at some of the ways these things are marketed. I'm just appalled by some of the ways these things are marketed. If you look at burgers, look at a burger, right? You never see a burger in a pan shot of far away. It's all almost like a pornographic shot of this big thing, you know, oozing goo. And the language frequently around it is the language of addiction. It will trigger your cravings and this kind of thing. And I think we have this enormous economic power arrayed against us that is absolutely dedicated to finding ways of prodding the nucleus, of manipulating our reward pathways in our brain chemistry. And along that way, it starts with the Facebook like, you know, button, and it goes to the, you know, social media, and of course, sugar and Coke and sodas and on and on and on like that. All of that stuff, it's all legal. And then way out at the end, you get the Sinaloa drug cartel. You know what I mean? It feels to me like there's this enormous amount of money and brain power devoted to prodding and plucking our brain chemistry in many, many ways, and getting us used to the idea, as you say, that pleasure is somehow fulfillment or contentment. And that is a huge part of our economy, you know, and it kind of prods us and gets us kind of prepared for deeper addiction, it seems to me, at times.
Yeah, that is a deep point. We are this sybaritic people that have the means to mistake pleasure for contentment. There are these more desperate people that aren't beholden to that effect, but they know how to manipulate us. They come over our border and take advantage of the fact that our society is not protecting ourselves or recognizing this ourselves, or if there's ever a choice between, well, do we allow the marketer to market aggressively for the pleasure centers, or do we protect the consumer? It's always the marketer that the deference is given to. I mean, this is almost like a sci-fi novel more than a story, a very, tangible, touchable story that you wrote. But there are those dynamics going on.
Oh, I think that that's one of the things that makes me doubt whether we can ever safely and maturely and responsibly legalize drugs in this country, because we have such a hard time culturally. We just don't have a culture of standing up to big moneyed interests and saying, you can't do that. We have, the Bill of Rights and so on, which has been interpreted to mean that you can market any damn thing you want in any way you want, it sounds like. But it seems to me, too, in our culture, we just don't have this ability to say, no, nope, that's not going to work, because we believe you might make a ton of money, but that's not the most important thing. Standing up to moneyed interests is just, we don't do it well. That's one of the reasons. If you look at the marijuana legalization that's gone on in several states, I find it appalling, I have to say, that we are allowing in many of those states marijuana, which grows perfectly well in the sun. Marijuana can now legally be sold for commercial sale after it's been grown indoors. Indoor grown pot is an abomination. Carbon footprint of marijuana is just outrageous. Well, there's no way we should be legalizing marijuana that's grown indoors, but we don't have the willingness or the ability culturally, politically, I don't know, economically, to say, no, we'll allow this to be legal in these cases, but not if you're going to grow it indoors and with the carbon footprint that one bud of marijuana is going to represent. We just don't have that in our DNA.
And here in my city, we haven't legalized it, but we've not unlegalized it. So you can't really sell it, but no one's prosecuting you for selling it. It's not a serious, systematic, well thought out system. In California, you could go to any doctor, I guess they had to be a doctor, complain of neck pain, and you'd get your medical marijuana card. And that was all seen as, a necessary workaround to correct an injustice. But really, what was it saying? That no one's serious about this. There are no possible effects to worry about it. It's just like marketing. And I'm sure that the puritanical parts of America will make it so that actually selling to 16-year-olds will be quote-unquote discouraged. But of course, this is going to happen. And 14-year-old, this is going to happen more and more. And the sale to 14-year-olds will happen way before the scholarship is in about what it does to the brain of these kids. It's inevitable.
Yeah, now I think this is, having lived in Mexico, this is very upsetting to watch. Because in Mexico, I learned, if I didn't know already, I saw firsthand what happens when you undercut the rule of law. And I saw the effect on poor people. The reason we have so much immigration from Mexico is, one basic reason is because there is no rule of law in Mexico. And so many people view their chances of moving ahead as only connected to how much power they can be affiliated with. And most people, a lot of these folks have no power. And so they're willing to risk their lives, literally risk their lives to come north. I saw this over and over and over and over in many parts of the country. And it bothers me enormously when I see in the United States this kind of cavalier approach to the rule of law. If you want to make it legal, then do it in a mature, responsible adult way. But this idea, like you described, of kind of like half-baked thing, it just bothers me, because I've seen the damage that can come when you approach the law in that half-baked kind of way.
I want to talk specifically about homelessness, because there is an existing idea that if you're somewhat progressive about homelessness, you think of it as a problem of housing. People don't have enough housing. But B, what you were talking about before, there's a lot of trauma and people self-medicate. I wonder what you think about that term in relation to the drugs you're talking about. People self-medicate, they might become addicted. And then sadly enough, once addicted, they lose their homes. Is that actually how it's playing out with the new meth and the fentanyl that you've been documenting?
Sure, to some degree, sure. The homeless story is a very complicated story. It's about as complicated as every homeless person out there, it would seem to me. I would say that, that what I've encountered, frankly, is a very, very, however, strident, unyielding approach to homelessness. It says that all homelessness is basically caused by lack of affordable housing, and therefore the solution to homelessness is more affordable housing. And it's true that the housing is part of the issue, and affordable housing is part of the issue, and for some people it's absolutely the issue. But as you watch this, these two drugs spread nationwide, I think they are absolutely part of the homeless story and have been for a few years now. Certainly methamphetamine, so prevalent over the last decade or so in so many parts of the country, is driving people to homelessness on one hand. But then there are many reasons why people end up homeless. But regardless of why you ended up homeless, this meth is so prevalent now that you use it while on the street, and therefore it makes you much more it makes it much more difficult to get you out of homelessness. It kind of inures you to homelessness, drives you out of kind of away from reality, and so you're no longer living in this grim reality that or facing this grim reality that you're living in. There's no doubt that housing is part of the issue. It is not the only issue, though, and that is really, I think, the problem that we're facing.
There's a good anecdote in the afterword of your book. I don't need to tell you, but I'll tell the audience, where a housing advocate or a homelessness advocate in West Virginia says, see, proof that homelessness is about money for housing is that West Virginia is extremely affordable and we have no homeless problem, but we do have a drug problem. Only that information is outdated. It's as outdated as knowledge of what the new meth is doing to people is.
Precisely. And that's why I wish he had visited that fellow who wrote that, using West Virginia as the proof that meth can't be involved in homelessness. I wish he had visited West Virginia as I did and wrote three chapters in my book about one of those towns that was mightily affected, had no homelessness. Town of Clarksburg, West Virginia, in about 2017, really had very little homelessness, one or two people, really. And then this meth began to arrive in just staggering quantities. And very quickly, people began to go out of their mind. And very quickly, people are on the street. And very quickly, then people are in that town. It wasn't so much tents people were living in as abandoned houses, destroying houses. As soon as a house went vacant, was up for rent, they would come in and kind of strip it of the copper wire. And there was all kinds of stories. But basically, a lot of those folks were homeless, living in abandoned houses.
As you point out, this kind of meth also makes the user fight a home with walls and want to live in a tent.
Exactly. And to me, that's the remarkable thing that we're seeing across the country. And I think many tent encampments are almost real-time displays of how profoundly drugs of abuse, and these drugs of abuse, given their supply and their potency, especially masterful job of squelching or redirecting, better put, our basic instincts for survival. And that's what drugs do in general. Alcohol does it, heroin do it, but these drugs do it especially well, to say the only thing that you really need is dope. You know, and that is what you're seeing in tent encampments. And we're seeing it now as the temperatures drop. We were seeing it last year as the temperatures got very, very scary. People freezing to death, people enduring frostbite, losing digits because they were afraid to leave the tents and the homeless encampments where they had easy access to their drugs. And to me, that is a profound result of, again, getting back to the supply of these extraordinarily potent drugs.
When it comes to homelessness, I want to make explicit what you're actually saying. Experts have long noted a correlation between homelessness, mental health problems, and drug addiction. And it's not really clear what the causal flows are, and for different people, it's probably a different calculation. But now, I think experts aren't sufficiently, what you're saying is there aren't sufficiently thinking about and understanding how these new drugs, this new concoction of meth and fentanyl, especially the meth, though, actually affects the user and how that accelerates the entire problem and maybe confounds the normal ways we used to think about the correlations between those three comorbidities.
Yes, and I would say that's right, and that everything, these drugs change everything, and ideas and approaches and policies that were devised or thought out pre-meth, pre-fentanyl nationwide in these ghastly quantities and potency, these drugs will thwart those best intentioned ideas, and I just think that we have not adjusted our thinking. Even as, you know, our thinking, the drugs have changed, our thinking hasn't to some degree, you know what I mean? And to me, that is really kind of what's going on. It's not to say that there is no issue of housing. It's just to say that there is so much more than that. And to use one tool, this is the other thing. When you use one tool to address an issue that is rooted in our brain chemistry, you are going to run into problems. We did that in the drug war. We used law enforcement. Now, the thing about law enforcement is not that the drug war had its problems, not because we used law enforcement, but because we only used law enforcement. We decided that we could eradicate, literally, this was the phrasing at the time, literally eradicate all pain using one tool, and that was the prescription opioid painkiller, suggesting that we, as I've heard people talk about very seriously, we can solve the housing problem with just housing, to me, just seems out of step with what is clearly the case in tent encampments and cities and rural areas too, I would say, across the country, that we need a multidisciplinary approach to deal with these very, very powerful drugs that are a major source, a major driving force in our homelessness issue.
So I'm hearing what you say about drug legalization, about homelessness, about law enforcement. Are you a progressive? Are you a conservative? What are you? How do you map on to politics?
I am a reporter who bases his conclusions on many, many interviews on many parts of the country, talking with people of all walks of life, but mainly people who are living it firsthand. And that would be addicts in recovery, paramedics, ER docs, cops, outreach workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I try very hard to be a reporter of immersion in the topic, number one. But then also very, very open to finding my own independent way. I've been an independent reporter most of my 35 years, freelancer, and I'm not here to kowtow to conservative or liberal or left-wing or right-wing orthodoxies and dogmas. And so I'm finding my own way, but it's based on the reporting that I have done, period, end of story.
Sam Quiñones is the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. That was a National Book Critics Circle Award winner. His new one, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, is indeed a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. Thank you so much, Sam.
Great to be with you, Mike. Thank you very much for the time.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Rachel Yucatel, and I'm here to invite you to listen to my podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. This podcast delves into the lives of those who have been reduced to a single headline. Each episode will take a closer look at the stories of those who are on a mission to change their narrative. Join me as we uncover the truth behind the misconceptions, shed light on the stories of those who have perhaps been wrongfully portrayed, explore the complexities of the human experience, and celebrate the power of second chances. Who doesn't love a good comeback story?
And now the spiel. 97-year-old Imgard Fürchner found herself being sentenced in a criminal court in Germany today. A year earlier, she was supposed to travel to court from her assisted living facility, but instead of heading to the trial, she went on the lam. She hopped into a taxi before being detained at a nearby train station. But they were able to catch the nonagenarian. They refused her request for a trial in absentia, which isn't allowed under German law, and they put her in the dock. The charge, for which she was not originally put into custody, but allowed to travel to court on her own, or to try to avoid doing so, as was her gambit last September, the charge was serious. Aiding and abetting the murder of 10,505 people. Press accounts said nearly 11,000 people. NBC said last year that it was 11,412 people, which I think it was, but they brought it down to 10,505 people. In any case, it was a lot of people she was accused of helping kill. Because as a young woman, a girl of 18 and 19, Fürchner worked as a secretary, taking shorthand at the Stutthof death camp. 65,000 Jews, Poles, Russians, Jehovah's Witnesses were murdered there. And the 10,500-ish figure was the death toll during the time Fürchner was employed as a civil servant. Fürchner said she didn't know what was going on. The court did not believe her. And the sheer number of those processed and disappeared, plus her status in the central office, the nerve center, as it were, makes her claim seem dubious. Germany used to not prosecute low-level administrative functionaries, but in past years they have been, maybe because they're running out of officers and SS insignia-wearing soldiers to prosecute. So it was said of Irmgard Fürchner, as has been said of the last few convicted of crimes like hers, quote, Fürchner's trial could be the last to take place in Germany into Nazi-era crimes. That's a quote from the BBC. Fürchner's trial took place, her conviction took place, and her sentencing took place today in juvenile court. Isn't that macabre? Because she was 18 and 19 when she worked at the camp. We are vastly different people between the ages of 18 and 97. So different, like the ship of Theseus. Parts may have been worn down, replaced, and worn down several times over. Yes, we're the same collection of DNA, and yes, the acts and sins of our past still have reverberations into the present. But I don't know what I think of the prosecution. Accountability, that's the watchword. And so we have the specter of Fürchner trying to escape. She's showing guilt there, does she not? Or she's showing a frail, old, confused lady not wanting to face the charges of the worst kind of crimes against humanity. And even if that's the case, how much should we allow that? Of course, loathe the Nazis, and I have no sympathy for Fürchner or any of Hitler's willing executioners, at least the Fürchner of the teenage years. But I'm trying to think about what is the quality of justice delivered in a juvenile court to a 97-year-old defendant. I will tell you what the sentence was, the sentence for playing the part in the murder of 10,500 people. 2 years, suspended. It works out to a term of 100 minutes per person killed, or would have if it weren't a suspended sentence. It is kind of ridiculous. It is kind of bizarre. I'm thinking, is it obscene, or is it the only sane act we can impose on an obscene circumstance? I believe the outcome was dictated every step of the way by their only being one acceptable answer to the question right before the authorities. I mean, do you not charge her? Do you say, live your life despite what you've done? No, you can't do that. So you charge her. And if you charge her, you got to try her. And if you try her, the law dictates it takes place in juvenile court. And if you try her in juvenile court, you can't find her not guilty. And if you find her guilty, you really can't make a 97-year-old go to prison. What kind of statement would that be about our commitment to humanity? So there we have it. 100 minutes of life, a 97-year-old, some sort of statement about justice. I come back to the idea that the perversion of what the Nazis did was so all-encompassing and reverberated so strongly through time and space that we're left with this result. The Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations commented on the 97-year-old's two-year suspended sentence, quote, "It shows that it's never too late to ensure that there was some accountability for crimes committed of such horrific nature." Some accountability is what was achieved. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer, Michelle Pasquez, COO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru, gee-puru, doo-puru, and thanks for listening.